Hey guys, back on the Young Turks, Cenk Uygur, Kim Horcher, everybody.
What?
What is this? Star of Nerd Alert, Anna Kasparian, obviously. Our members of the day are Gary Proctor and Maria Silva. Today in the post game, we'll discuss a little bit about the funding that we got and give you guys a little bit more sense of what we're going to do with it. So tytnetwork.com/join to get the post games. And tonight we got Old School. Mark Thompson's in for that. That should be fun. So everybody check that out as well. Now let me read a couple of quick tweets. Jess, it's just me. I talk too fast. I know for sure Cenk Uygur has that finger ready, just itching to press that button. Ladies and gentlemen, we got about Manafort. Okay, but hold, not yet. Joseph Hughes 4 says, it's a nice switch to see the MAGA crowd calling a white Southern GOP male lazy.
That's a great point. I didn't think of it that way.
That's a good point. Finally, the Mad Lib says, McConnell, nobody knew that Trump could be so complicated. That's funny. Okay, unfortunately, what is not funny is the next update I have for you guys, so let me go ahead and tell you that. We have a new update in breaking news. North Korea has threatened Guam again, but very specifically. They say that on their state television, which of course run by the government, that they are going to launch 4 intermediate range missiles at Guam. They say that they are going to present that plan and Kim Jong-un will make the decision on whether to execute it. But they are very, very specific. They say the Hwasong 12 rockets, that's the name of the rocket, not that there will be 12 rockets, will be launched by the Korean People's Army, will cross the sky above Shimane, Hiroshima, Koichi prefectures of Japan, and will land in Guam. They say they will fly 3,356.7 kilometers for 1,065 seconds. I'm being serious, this is their press release, and hit the waters 30 to 40 kilometers away from Guam. So that is the plan that they're saying that for their line of attack against Guam, and they are saying that they will be doing it in mid-August. I have never seen anyone declare this specific a plan of attack against another country and announce it publicly. Now, again, they huff and they puff, and they've been doing this a long time, and they usually do not actually attack people. They launch test missiles all the time. But we have an extraordinary showdown here, and I'm been telling you guys this is very real, because we have two incredibly unpredictable, unintelligent leaders in Kim Jong-un in North Korea and Donald Trump in the US. And they both have incredibly fragile egos, and they keep threatening one another. Trump said that he will bring fire and fury like no one has ever seen before, indicating that he might use nukes. Then today, this morning, he said, yes, in tweets, he referred to how we have nukes, they've been updated, modernized, and they're ready to go. So it is very clear that he's threatening nuclear war against North Korea. North Korea, in return, said they would hit Guam. And then today, this update is, here's exactly how and when we're gonna hit Guam. So unless there are cooler heads, and I don't know that any exist in the Trump administration or the Jong-un administration, the world could be in a world of trouble here. Lindsey Graham, Republican senator from South Carolina, on TV said today, if they come anywhere near Guam, which is, this part is normal, if you attack us, of course we'll attack you back. Not necessarily with nukes, that's not the right way to do it. But he said, if they come anywhere near Guam, we will launch. So again, not necessarily nukes, but Trump is saying, yes, nukes. So this will be, if this goes forward, and apparently we're on the clock, mid-August is not that far, it's about a week away. We might have nuclear weapons used again on Earth. There is no winning a nuclear war. There's only losers in a nuclear war, and millions of lives are on the line. This is exactly what we were afraid of if Donald Trump got elected. And right now, he's blundered his way right into the middle of a conflict like we've never seen before. So let's hope to God that it somehow cools down. But right now, it looks like a worldwide disaster. Okay, so that was breaking news. Now Kim's gonna give us the rest of the news from this hour.
Oh boy, starting on a great note. I can think of no one better to lead the Young Turks than Cenk and Anna, but for some reason, I'm gonna do it now. Let's do it. Recently, we've been discussing important issues like, can women actually succeed in technology? Can they code? Well, instead of turning to pseudoscience and vague ideas of what a meritocracy is. Let's turn to some actual coders. There was research done on GitHub, which is a massive collective of programmers and coders working together in an open source community together to see. So one group of researchers went to see if women were discriminated against in coding. Mm-hmm. The researchers found that code written by women was approved at a higher rate, 78.6% than code written by men. This is when they were doing certain things called pull requests, which is when you work with different coders, perhaps you know them, perhaps you don't, to collaborate on a project. So when the woman coders were not identified as being gendered, they generally had their requests pulled more. And when they were identified as women, a little bit less. I think we have a chart for this. Yeah, so this came from PeerJ Computer Science. It shows acceptance rates. The orange one is women. The purple one is men for their code or, yeah, their code written by them being accepted by people running different programs. And then we also have another chart. So this is acceptance rate by gender and perceived gender with 95% Clapper-Pearson confidence intervals for insiders and outsiders. Insiders and outsiders indicate whether or not someone knows the coders or not, or just taking, you know, cold requests from other people they don't know, and whether or not they were identified or not. So in this, they, out of over 4 million people on GitHub, they gendered ID'd 1,426,127, that's 35% of them, and that was used to conduct this research. So overall, women's pull rates were very high.
Okay, so let's start to break this down. I love this because this is real. It's not an experiment. It was based on actual pull requests on GitHub, and it is an enormous amount of data because there was 3 million pull requests. So this is people actually taking action on something they deeply care about, a project that they're working on. Mm-hmm. So they want results. So we know based on this overwhelming data in this particular example here, when they look back at it, and remember they didn't look, it was not an experiment, they look back at it to see what actually, what human beings actually did. Mm-hmm. So when they see that it's a woman, they accept the code a little less.
They request that code less.
Yeah, so they the women write the code, they say okay, a little less, but not, it's not a huge number. It's not a huge difference, but a little less. But when they don't know that it's a woman, it's gender neutral. But in fact, then you could look at to see men and women. Women do, as Kim explained, about 4 points better, 78.6 to 74.6. So I think that has a number of ramifications. Obviously, James Amore, who worked at Google, recently came out with a memo saying that women are not necessarily biologically equipped to work in the tech field in the same way that men are. And one of the issues that I had with that when we discussed it on the show yesterday was he was, you know, he would make these huge generalizations and he would at best have one study to back it up. And I said, wait a minute. I think it's an interesting conversation and we should have that conversation. And in fact, this leads to a further conversation on that matter in a way that's somewhat uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But you can't make generalizations based on just one data point. And if you're good at tech, you should probably know that. And to be fair, this is only one look as well. I would want this study to no end. But at least there was 3 million pull requests here, so it's pretty significant.
Right, and even the student researchers who looked into this were shocked at the results because they were actually expecting the opposite outcome, right? Mm-hmm. And so it is an amazing bit of research looking into the biases that we might all have, right? Because I don't think that their peers looked at the coding and you know thought, oh, I just don't want it if it's a woman. I don't think that it's something that they explicitly say out loud. I think it's an internal bias that they're maybe unaware of. And I think that it also has a lot to do with social conditioning, right? The way that mass media portrays women in STEM jobs, and how, you know, this idea that they're not equipped is perpetuated over and over again. And so I like this study, but at the same time, I think that the conversation is important. And my biggest issue with the story involving that Google engineer was, I agree with you, he generalized. There were issues with what he had written. But the way Google handled it, I think, unfortunately stopped the conversation. It squashed the conversation when we should have a real conversation about it.
I think there are some legal repercussions, I mean, or ways they handle this, because if he had done it on social media, for instance, they'd have to probably let him have his freedom of speech, but this was done in an enclosed employee, was it a forum?
Yeah, it's like an internal forum type thing.
And when we're looking at that, I mean, it is up to them to govern this as they see fit. He isn't really protected in any way. And I was reading about different peer reviews for getting raises and promotions within Google, and knowing that that is there as a bias is kind of creating an unfair work environment, or at least a hostile work environment.
So to that point, Susan Wojcicki just wrote an article about this in Fortune, and she's the CEO of YouTube, obviously a big part of Google, and she was, it's actually out of her garage or her house that they started Google. She's one of the first employees there, so obviously incredibly successful in the tech field. And she said, look, I've had these biases directed at me endlessly throughout my whole career. That's fine, I made it anyway, right? But it's not fine because I have to protect all the people who now will have to face the same stereotypes, the same biases. So now are they going to think that women are neurotic and hence don't belong in tech? And then is it fair to say then they feel it's a hostile work environment when they face those stereotypes based purely on their gender and not on their individuality, right? And even if that's not what DeMaurier intended, that is certainly a lot of what people got out of this. And she made a similar point that I did in the video yesterday, which is, she said, look, if you put anybody else and said, well, blacks have lower ability to code, or people who are gay have lower ability, or Hispanic, well, of course it would be unacceptable, right? And so just because you're saying it's women doesn't make it any more acceptable.
I think that women who are working at Google right now, or women who are working in coding jobs or in Silicon Valley who are experiencing this type of sexism firsthand, I know how difficult it is. And look, the onus is not on you. I definitely understand that. But I love the women who are fighting back, and they're not being intimidated by these ridiculous generalizations and the insults that are being thrown their way. Like, keep fighting, you know? And the reason why I say that is because, like, let's keep it real. Even this work environment has changed considerably in the last 10 years. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was definitely not happy when I wasn't on the first hour, when I didn't get to cover the political news. And I fucking fought for that, you know? And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because every woman in every industry experiences the same shit. And my argument is, don't let these guys who like to make generalizations about you and who like to judge you discourage you from doing what you want to do. You know what I'm saying? Because another part of this that I think I'm frustrated by is, I think people who are commenting on it are overly victimizing the women in these work environments, acting as if like we're all weak and we can't handle a little bit of criticism. And that gets under my skin too.
But it's not a matter of handling criticism, Anna. It's about prejudging them. And so, and look, you know, you bring that up. I don't agree with you. Yeah. And so it had nothing to do with whether you were capable to be in the first hour. And only on the Young Turks would you have this conversation in public, out in the open. John had been practicing to do the first hour and had done it over and over again. That's why he got a shot at it. So we disagree on that, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter, because at the end we have plenty of women who are represented on air, etc. But by the way, I always admit to this, which is that, look, when we first started hiring here, I hired a lot of people that I knew, and I knew more guys. And so That is exactly what's wrong. It was not bad intent. But so the reason that you fight for diversity is because people do hire people they know. And if they're only hiring from a certain subset, whether it's whites or in, depending on the situation, it might be a different religion or gender, etc. That's why you have these conversations that are sometimes uncomfortable so that we can get to a better place. Now back to GitHub. Look, this study is not the end all be all too, because it is already looking at women who are coders. And so there's the issue of self-selection here. So I understand that. That's why I said in the studies related to that DeMore quoted and this one, you've got to study it a hell of a lot better than that before you start making generalizations about men or women. And then finally, so according to this data, and if you just took, hey, who's the better coders? Meritocracy, right? Right wing always says meritocracy. Of course, we believe in meritocracy too. We believe that you should just judge people based on their individual success. And hence, based on these results, if you said, hey, meritocracy, just hire women because they're better coders. It's the data. The data shows they're better coders, right? Well, that would be stupid because, first of all, it's a 4-point difference. And if you have a random guy and a random woman who are applying for the job, that 4-point difference does not apply to those two individuals. They're individuals. So give everyone the same shot, give them equality of opportunity. Don't judge them based on stereotypes. And then judge them as individuals. So we're not looking for women or minorities, etc., to have some sort of advantage. What we're saying is historically they've been at a disadvantage and partly because of the stereotypes. So let's just level the playing field so they have equality of opportunity. And now that we know men are not as good coders as women, men should have equality of opportunity too. Don't discriminate against men just because they're not good coders.
Okay, I'm gonna move on right now to Wisconsin. So Donald Trump and Paul Ryan have been vocal supporters of the idea of building a Foxconn plant in the state of Wisconsin in order to bolster jobs and really get the state economy going. It's gonna be a great success, or it won't. Because recently nonpartisan budget analysts at the Capitol said that this is not going to be the case. In fact, they're not even going to break even. I think this is number six, graphic number six. Okay. So the plant will cost $10 billion and have 13,000 employees. So Wisconsin will not break even on this investment that they're making until 2043 at the earliest. And if only 10% of the 13,000 workers come from out of state, that will push that back two more years to 2045 at the earliest projection. Now these projections are speculative because it's hard to know where the market will be, where Foxconn's standing will be in the future or even the very near future. But it does look like, according to this analysis, that it will not be as profitable as the governor and the president and the speaker have.
So part of the reason why it might not be as profitable as it's being portrayed by those on the right is because this multinational corporation is getting, you know, a ton of tax benefits. Mm-hmm. They're getting about $3 billion in taxpayer money just to open this plant in Wisconsin. And so it's just, you know, we're gonna pay you with our taxpayer money to come and build jobs in our state, which sounds like, okay, well, if that's what it takes to build companies in these states and create more jobs, awesome. Except when you do an analysis, you find out, okay, well, I mean, taxpayers aren't even gonna break even until, you know, 2045 possibly. And so there are people living in Wisconsin right now that are looking at these numbers and they're questioning whether or not this is even a good idea, especially because it's not just the financial component of it. There are also some concessions that lawmakers in Wisconsin have made in regard to environmental regulations. So they wouldn't have to take out the same permits that other factories or other companies have had to take out in the past. So I think that it's important to do an analysis. I think it's also important to bring jobs into the country, but we got to do it a smart way. And if we set this precedent where we pay these massive corporations to bring jobs here, well, then every corporation is going to want the same thing.
Well, it's also a Taiwanese corporation. It's right. Not an American corporation. You may also remember Foxconn and the controversies they've had in the past with their factory workers. So we do have a chart on Wisconsin's payments to Foxconn in order to make this happen. It'll only be $2 million in the upcoming future, but then it'll balloon by several hundreds of millions after that. After seeing the numbers, Representative David Crowley said, "There's no way I can currently support this. I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. When you talk about what we're giving Foxconn, this is a lot of money that technically my grandkids might be paying toward."
So now let me give more context. There is nothing that says that the plant can't leave. So they can take all of the tax advantages and then go, see you, wouldn't want to be you. And why do you, to Anna's point about the environmental regulation, why do you need to make exceptions for polluting the rivers for Foxconn unless they're planning to pollute the rivers? So that's worrisome.
And real quick, I do want to jump in on that because we did an original story on that, or we did the original story on that. And then I looked into the wording of the actual proposal, and it essentially indicates that they wouldn't have to take the permits that other corporations have to take out when it comes to disposing like mud, dredge into these rivers. However, the big issue, in my opinion, is the fact that they'll also be able to connect man-made bodies of water to natural bodies of water without getting a permit. And so there's a reason why those regulations are in place, and the fact that they're gonna be able to do this without getting the necessary permits is what concerns me.
Yeah, David Sirota did a really good piece on that, both for IB Times and on TYT Politics, you should check that out. And then, but like the overall idea is the one that bothers me the most. Companies win first and foremost. So they get the exemptions on the regulations on their drudge and all that. They get giant tax breaks. Yes, they hire some people, but those people, you know, we don't get the benefits of that all the way till 2043, 2045, at least the tax benefits of it. So it's not just Republican 101, which it most certainly is, but it's elite 101, which is make sure you take care of corporations first and then hope that it trickles down to you. And so when people look at this and go, well, I'm not sure that it's the right idea to just trust corporations. You see what I'm saying? Like, so we make this deal where they get all the goodies first, and then, but they're a corporation, they have no loyalty to America or even to Taiwan or anything else. All they want is to maximize profits. So the minute that that deal turns disadvantageous to them, well, I already got your money and they're gonna go.
Exactly. So basically, the state of Wisconsin will have to continue paying them in taxpayer money year after year just to keep that factory there. And now some residents in the state are realizing, maybe that's not such a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, these projections are only based on if they follow it exactly.
Yeah.
And even then, that's 25 years, that's ridiculous. And then it's just like, well, this is best case scenario. It won't be, or it wouldn't be the scenario that actually would pander out probably.
Oh yeah, that's a great point by Kim, which is,
this is
if things work out.
Best case scenario,
right? Yeah. Imagine if things don't work out. And so look, we all want jobs. I also don't want a race to the bottom where every state says, oh yeah, Foxconn, I'll give you a $4 billion tax break. And then you don't have to, you know, it won't pay out for Mississippi until 2065. So there's gotta be a smart way to keep jobs and to add jobs without giving huge tax giveaways to these folks. And remember, look, what do Republicans always complain about? That's my money, that's my money. Well, they're taking your money and give it to this giant foreign corporation in the hopes that they stick around long enough for those jobs to be meaningful. I'm not sure that's a good bargain. Okay, we gotta take a break here, guys. When we come back, who discriminates against gays more, Muslims or evangelicals? Find out.
I gotta Google it.
All right, back on the Young Turks, Cenk, Kim, and Anna with you guys. First couple of tweets, the great Derp writes in, fun fact, it was a woman who coded the software used for the Apollo missions, Margaret Hefield Hamilton. On the Wisconsin story, your mama writes in, more corporate welfare, sadly, no matter what political persuasion you follow, this is commonplace in America. And James Rule says, are they calculating the healthcare costs from the environmental damage? Missed days, early death, chronic illnesses, it adds up. Another terrific point. No, they are not counting that. And to be fair, the Democrats in that case, it is the Republican governor, Scott Walker, who's pushing forward. Trump is bragging about it, and it is some Democrats that are tapping the brakes and saying maybe we shouldn't do this in Wisconsin. Okay, I forgot to tell you guys something that I'm really excited about. Tomorrow at 11:30 a.m. Eastern, I am going to do one of the interviews that I am most excited about. Arian Foster is going to be on the show. Okay, so Arian Foster is a great running back from the NFL, and you might say, "Oh, okay, I don't care about sports." No, no, no. He was one of the better running backs in college, and didn't get drafted at all by the NFL in an incredibly deep draft because he was an atheist. So it's an amazing story. He made it into the NFL anyway and became the top running back in the league. So Arian Foster on the program tomorrow. Members get it live. Okay, so if you're a member, watch it live at 11:30 a.m. Eastern tomorrow. TYTnetwork.com/join to become a member. You'll get old school in the post game tonight, etc. But if you're not, of course, we will put it up later on TYT interviews and maybe some clips on TYT Sports as well. All right, what's next, Kim?
All right, well, United Airlines is in trouble again after a family from Texas says their dog died while in the cargo hold of a plane that was delayed for 2 hours. The dog is named Lulu.
Oh.
Yeah, Lulu was a 5-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel and was cleared by a veterinarian to fly days before that Lulu was boarded on the plane. And the family doesn't know what's going on so far. United has responded with a statement. "We are so sorry to learn of Lulu's passing and have reached out to our customer to offer our condolences and assistance. We are deeply upset any time an animal suffers an injury, this injury being death, while traveling with us, and especially grieved in the rare instance where one passes away. We are conducting a thorough review of this incident." Interestingly, since 2012, 1/3 of all animal deaths on US carriers occurred on United Airlines. I looked it up. There were 136 animal deaths on US planes during that time. 53 were attributed to United Airlines.
That's insane.
Wow. They say on the rare occurrence. Now, that is rare given the number of flights there is, but apparently a little less rare if it's on United. So, look, there are different airlines that have different issues for different reasons. So, for example, there's a great book about why Korean Airlines crashed more in the past, not today. And it turned out that the co-pilots, because of cultural reasons, were too polite. So even if they were about to run into a mountain, they would not tell the pilot, "Hey, watch out, we're about to die." They thought it was too rude, and so they would crash in the mountain and everyone would die.
What?
Which seems a little ruder.
No.
Okay. So that's a real story. It's amazing. Now, again, that didn't happen that frequently, but it happened more frequently on Korean Air in the past. They've now corrected for it. So there's some chance that United is doing something a little wrong.
Right.
In this particular case, they say, well, the air conditioning had gone out in the main cabin. Imagine what it was like for the dog.
Jeez.
In the cargo hold.
So that's okay. Very likely what happened, but they'll have to investigate, find out for sure.
What I never understand is, first of all, why do they board people on the plane when they know, or before they've checked to make sure that we're not gonna be stuck on a tarmac for a couple hours before the flight happens? Or why don't you make sure that when we land, we're not gonna have to stay on the tarmac for several hours? Because I feel like it's a common thing. There's been multiple times where you're stuck on the tarmac for several hours, in addition to the amount of time you're stuck on the plane. And miraculously, the air conditioning always malfunctions when you're stuck on the tarmac.
Yes.
So, there was a story that we didn't get to a couple weeks ago where people were literally stuck on the plane on the tarmac for over 5 hours. Mm-hmm. And people started throwing up because the air conditioning wasn't working.
Oh,
they weren't giving
torture.
Out food. The only thing that they would give out was water. And it's just ridiculous. One person actually called 911. They called 911. An ambulance showed up, but they said, "We can't take you off the plane." I don't get why it's so difficult to get the people off the plane, especially if you have several individuals throwing up. So I don't know. It's this weird, you know, airline policy that I've never understood. I'm sure there might be a good reason for it, but it's not a good idea.
Yeah, look, I feel bad for pet owners. Look, I have a pet too, but putting it on a plane is a little bit dangerous, right? It's because look, we don't know why they have all the issues that they do. And I, of course, had a somewhat infamous fight with American Airlines and where I thought they were acting irrationally. And by the way, I was proven right, because it turns out they did have a plane and were choosing not to bring it. So sometimes they're in a difficult spot and there's nothing they could do. And sometimes there is something they could do, they just don't want to do it. But if your pet is in the cargo hold, and then it becomes a little bit more a matter of urgency for you that, hey, we got to fix this thing, otherwise Lulu's going to die.
Well, I looked into it too. A lot of people online or organizations online seem to have an issue with placing animals in the cargo hold to begin with, because they are living creatures. And there are different conditions down there. According to PETA, 300 animals have died in cargo holds in US planes since 2005, which I mean, it goes back to what you were saying of why this needless regulation? Why does this defy common sense even? Mm-hmm. Why are we going this route? What is the purpose? Does this help people?
So it's, look, I'm not saying that it's an easy issue, because I don't want your pit bull sitting next to me. I'm, you know, we're stuck on a plane. If we get stuck for 5 hours without air conditioning on a tarmac and your pit bull's breathing down my neck, I'm not that in favor of it. I'm going to keep it real on that. On the other hand, if he's in the cargo hold, he's almost certainly going to die without that air conditioning for 5 minutes, and I don't want your dog to die. Right. So we don't have a great answer here.
Politeness and what is right for health and being alive.
Yes, yeah. And so
it's a balance, and I get it. You know, being a dog owner, I love dogs, so sometimes I don't consider how other people feel about dogs, because in my eyes, it's like, yeah, just let the dog on the plane. What's the big deal? You know, why does the dog have to be in the cargo hold? But you're right. I mean, some people might be allergic to pet dander, and it might be a health concern. So it's a delicate balancing act, but I think it's important for these airline companies to understand, like, there are living creatures in the cargo hold, you know, take the proper precautions to make sure that, you know, there are safeguards in place.
So we'll end on my favorite story about dogs on a plane. Mark Halperin, who's in kind of an establishment writer, once tweeted there was a dog next to him in first class. It was such a cute dog, but he was like, how dare they basically allow this dog in first class? And everybody was like, you're right, that poor dog had to suffer with you sitting next to him. And he got so much hate on Twitter for it, which was well deserved. I think the dog had a bow tie.
It's a classy dog.
I saw this story about a cat being an honorary librarian at a library, and this one person was mad about the cat being there, and they got the cat removed, and the cat got reinstated, and everyone hated that person.
Yeah.
People like animals.
Look, let's see if I can get this done in time. You know what's coming. No?
Just
animals are innocent. You know it. All right. Anyway, guys, for the online crew, we do have a couple more stories for you guys, including whether evangelicals or Muslims don't like gays as which one likes gays less. Okay. Anyway, we'll see you guys then. Back on the Young Turks, I hear that YouTube is having an issue, not us, that's the benefit of membership, because I think you guys are the only ones watching this now. And you're watching it later. Anyway, Cenk, Kim, and Anna with you guys. Before I forget, everybody check out Nerd Alert, okay? YouTube.com/Nerd Alert. Okay, so Kim, what's next?
All right, well, President Donald Trump loves to blame, quote, radical Islamic terrorists as being a threat to the LGBTQ community. But is that really the case? Some recent findings from the Pew Research Center have found that Muslims have become much more accepting of gay and lesbian people in the last 10 years than other faith groups. So if you check this out, US Muslims are at 52% acceptance in 2017. That's a gain of 25%. And that is significantly higher when you look lower on this chart. We have under Millennial, Gen X, Baby Boomer, Protestant is also at 52 at a change of 13. White Evangelical is way low at 34% acceptance, though that is up 11 points. And then we have White Mainline at 76%, Black Protestant at 50%.
So lots of good news, bad news in here. So first piece of good news is that LGBT Americans are getting accepted by all groups more in the last 10 years. Now, it's not much of an increase for white evangelicals' acceptance of gays, but we're making progress at 11%. So let's just compare the two groups, because I hear that Muslims are incredibly scary. It turns out white Protestants say that Only 34% of them say that homosexuality should be accepted, whereas 52% of Muslims do. That's a big difference. So Muslims in America accept LGBT members of our community much more so than white Protestants do. So now, of course, there are caveats. First of all, it's American Muslims, and so it's not worldwide Muslims. So the people that are raging about the study saying, no, but you know what happens in the middle of Raqqa, Syria. Yeah, no, we know what happens. And so, but on the other hand, when Trump demagogues about what's going to happen in America, well, this is very relevant because these are the Muslims that are here. And then one more thing, it doesn't necessarily mean that white evangelicals are going to be more violent towards LGBT members. Although if you don't accept them, it does often correlate with violence. Not every one of them, not remotely, right? But higher percentages based on whether you accept or don't accept them. But it is possible that, of course, there's that cases like the Pulse shooting in Orlando where it was horrific violence and it was a Muslim who did it. So just giving you the full context for the story. But what would be great is if all Americans accepted all Americans, including gay Americans.
That's right. And so whenever we have discussions about accepting refugees or immigration into the United States, the question that keeps getting brought up over and over again by some on the right is, you know, should we pressure them to assimilate? Should we pressure them to accept American values? And, you know, my response to that is usually, how do you define American values, right? Because conservatives will think their values are American values. Progressives will think their values are American values. But you can look at polls to see how Americans feel about specific issues. And one of those specific issues is gay tolerance. And so we know the majority of Americans are in favor of gay rights. And, you know, we've made great strides when it comes to tolerance for the LGBT community. But how come when we have that discussion, it's always about Mexicans or Muslims or refugees? It's never about evangelicals. Are evangelicals pressured to conform to American values or what the majority of Americans think? How come we never have that conversation?
You know the answer. Well, yeah. They're white.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, so let's talk about two different angles to that. One is, because there was also a complaint, we're losing the culture wars, these liberals are taking over the culture. Well, okay, if that's true and a majority of America believes in liberal culture, according to your own logic, not our logic, your logic, you should conform. Yeah. Why aren't you assimilating to the majority mainstream culture in America, which is a liberal one? Okay, and second of all, you can't complain that Muslims and other groups are not assimilating to the idea of openness, tolerance, freedom, liberty, and equality for all, if you're not doing it yourself. So it turns out, according to this study, white Protestants, and all it does is poll them, it asks them, and they're the ones who say, no, I don't think gays should be equal. Mm-hmm. I don't accept them, right? Mm-hmm. So the number one problem we have, based on religious background, is that white Protestants won't conform to American values. Why won't you guys assimilate? Why do you stay in the middle of the country in your little caves and spew fear and hatred? Look, I'm using your logic, okay? In fact, I don't know if we should keep you in the country because I hear that people who don't assimilate are dangerous and should not be allowed. Right. And you don't believe in equality for all. So that's a giant problem. That makes you kind of un-American.
Right. And so look, that rhetoric is obviously problematic when it's directed toward the evangelical community. But I think it's an issue that they're unable to, you know, see how problematic their language is when they force it upon other communities or other groups of people that they just happen to not like.
So in fact, let's go to that, and that's why, of course, I say that. When it's an extreme statement against Muslims, everybody takes it like, oh, that's totally right. Normal. You make the same statement about evangelicals, they're like, how dare you? Based on what? No, you're the one who's not conforming. Anyway, so the reason I bring that up is that a different Pew survey found that 50% of white evangelicals think there is a great deal or fair amount of people who support extremism from Muslims in the US. Mm-hmm. No, it turns out there's a great deal or fair amount of white Protestants who support extremism. And I would argue that saying that gay people shouldn't have the same rights as every other American is an extreme position. Most of the country doesn't agree with you, and it is exactly the opposite of American principles. And more than half of white Protestants see Islam as a religion that encourages violence. So they're willing to discriminate. So if you do stereotypes about them, they will lose it. But doing stereotypes about other people, they're like, oh, that's, even though it's wrong, they feel is completely fine and commonplace. By the way, which religion is actually more violent? This is never going to solve as to who has committed more violence in history. That's a long and arduous debate that I think is actually pointless. It's almost certainly Christians with the Holocaust, let alone, first of all, on Holocaust alone, let alone all the other atrocities that have happened. But I'm telling you, that's a stupid, pointless exercise. So, but they'll say, no, there's a couple of bombs recently. So I'm going to discount the tens of millions of people murdered in all the wars and Holocausts and everything else that's ever happened. Okay, anyway, but which religion is more intrinsically violent? Well, you can go to the text, and software engineer Tom Anderson recently did do that last year. And he did a fun little experiment, where he had a computer program analyze the words in the Bible and the Quran, the New Testament and the Old Testament. Some people might be surprised, but the Old Testament was the most violent by far. And even in my discussion with Sam Harris, he acknowledges there's no question the Old Testament is the most violent of all the religious texts. Now, that doesn't mean the people who follow the Old Testament are the most violent. That would be kind of the kind of stupid assumptions that right wingers make about certain religions, right? But in terms of which one is inherently more violent, well, it turns out now the New Testament is much better. You know what's better than the New Testament? The Quran. So the Quran of those three texts is the least has the least violent passages. The New Testament is second, and the Old Testament is by far the worst. Now, that doesn't mean people who believe in the New Testament are bad people or Old Testament. We're not as stupid as those other people. It just means the texts are pretty violent overall, and the Old Testament is the most violent, but that does not impugn the motivations and the actions of the people who call themselves Jews or Christians or Muslims. I wish that others could be as rational in understanding that. And if you're going to say one text is more violent, you should actually be correct about that. And so if you're going to go on a warpath against the Old Testament and New Testament, okay, at least you're more accurate about the text, but don't make assumptions about the people.
What I did like about the data, though, this is on a different note, by analyzing it, I think you can come up with a few conclusions, which is there have been no negative changes in acceptance of gay Americans at all. They're mm-hmm. all positive, which means we are moving in that way. However, the lowest were, as pointed out, the white evangelical group. The highest acceptance was people totally unaffiliated with religion. Yeah. I just think that's interesting.
Right. I mean, I think that's unsurprising. But I like that you focused on the positives, because even within the evangelical community, you are seeing a little bit of progress. And I think it's because among younger evangelicals, mm-hmm. there's a lot more acceptance and tolerance toward communities that are different from them. Mm-hmm. And that's good news, which is why whenever I get down about what's going on in the country, I just think about millennials and younger generations and how, you know, they don't believe in conventional wisdom for the most part. I'm obviously overgeneralizing, but they're more educated. They have more resources that they've taken advantage of, like the internet. They grew up with the internet, and I think that's made them smarter and more tolerant. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, and if you're not religious, you don't have a reason to practice ancient hatreds. So it's in the text, and that's what's driving it. But we don't have to be controlled by those texts. And if you say your religion is more reformed, great, act like it. But better yet, get rid of all the religions and actually use logic and reason. And logically, there's no reason to discriminate against gays. It's hideous and un-American.
That's a good button.
Okay, last story is about Melania Trump.
All right. We get to do the story. Melania Trump is pretty popular in her home country of Slovenia, but you better not call her an escort or you will find yourself in a lot of trouble. I personally think it's more hideous to knowingly marry a monster than to potentially have been an escort, but that's just me. Oh no, I don't have the graphics. Okay. So she has her own attorney in Slovenia who is pretty well known for appearing on CNN, on national television, and has worked on a national level even, by the name of, and I'm probably mispronouncing this, Pirk Musar?
No one knows.
Okay, I was hoping one of you would know. who has talked a lot about fighting various legal battles for Melania back in Slovenia. On that she said to me that she did not want to sue anybody, that she was not doing that for money. She obviously does not need it. She just wanted me to set limits about what is allowed and what is not allowed. This is on the topic of a few magazines publishing stories about Melania. According to Anna Nemstova at the Daily Beast, people were publishing scandalous stories about Melania. Others were starting to try to use her name for their merchandising, even naming a cake after her. A magazine in Slovenia called Susie published an article that month saying that in the 1990s, Melania Knobs, as she was then known, worked for a modeling agency run by Paolo Zampoli in New York that, quote, operated as an escort agency for wealthy clients. A few weeks later, Pirk Musar and her client filed a lawsuit against Susie. And that's not the end of the lawsuits. In October of 2016, they filed a lawsuit against Tomas Mihalik in a court in
A place.
It accuses him of defamation, of making false and unverified statements against Melania. The case is still in the courts. And it doesn't necessarily need to be anything that is found scandalous or negative. In particular, photographer Matthew Attanian was Melania Knobs' roommate in the Zeckendorf Towers on Union Square in New York City before Melania even met Trump. Attanian told the Daily Beast that Melania's lawyers banned him from publishing any photographs of young Melania. On that, he said, "All I had was good wishes for her in the interviews. Then I get nasty letters from her lawyers threatening to sue me and bankrupt me if I publish any photos of her. This is not how you treat a friend." So yes, and there have also been people claiming to have been her boyfriend, and she says he was never my boyfriend. It's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
So fun times for Melania in Slovenia.
So the interesting thing is, you know, she aggressively went after a couple publications because they wrote about how she was allegedly an escort. And she says, no, I was never an escort. So she filed defamation lawsuits against them. One of those lawsuits was actually against the Daily Mail, who later retracted the story and issued an apology. But Susie Magazine in Slovenia refuses to retract the article. Mm-hmm. They're standing by it and they're very defiant. And so that is an ongoing legal battle in that country. But look, I never believed those articles. And besides which, I don't care. I don't care if she was an escort.
I don't care
what she's done with her life. It's completely irrelevant. But the fact that Susie Magazine stands by it and they refuse to retract it is interesting, especially considering the fact that you have this insanely powerful woman who has a powerful lawyer going after you. And they're like, no.
Yeah, look, it's impossible to determine anybody's motivations here because when it comes to the magazine, they could be just getting more attention. And maybe they view that as a net positive and they'll settle at the end. Who knows? Or they think it's true and they don't want to get intimidated. But now remember, Melania, Donald Trump is unpopular in Slovenia because it's a much more liberal country. Mm. But Melania is very popular because they feel like she's adding a soft touch, they say, to Donald Trump, and she's representing her country well, and it's fine. So I don't know what their motivation is. When it comes to Melania, I can tell you strategically she's made a mistake here. Because going after this magazine, who cares, you know, about this random magazine in Slovenia? All it does is it puts that story about how she might have been an escort back in the news over and over and over again. So it's just a bad strategy. Now, I don't know why she's so defensive about former relationships.
Even a friendship.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a friendship or you had a relationship or you had boyfriends, some of the cases are before she was 22. So what? It would be weird if you didn't have boyfriends before 22. It'd be weird if you didn't date anyone before Trump. Actually, it was super weird. It was dating Trump.
I don't think it's about the fact that she dated people prior to Trump. Of course she did. I think the concern is that people will look to cash in by airing maybe some of her dirty laundry. I mean, think about it. There might have been people in her past that she confided in. They might know personal things about her that she doesn't want published out there. And so I get it. And look, I get what you're saying, because the strategy does sound like a dumb one if you don't want this. Sorry, there's a fly.
There's a fly just flying all around our heads.
Yeah. I get it. By suing and going after this rinky-dink publication in Slovenia, you're bringing more attention to it. But I can also say, you know, having gone through similar defamatory claims against me, like, it's frustrating because people get to decide what your reputation is for you, and they get to defame you as much as they want, and you feel powerless against it. So it's a really difficult balancing act. And you know, I'm not criticizing her at all. I completely understand why she would want to go after them, you know, with a lawsuit.
Yeah, and there's just no way of knowing, guys, because if she wasn't an escort, she'd be pissed and she would do this. If she was an escort, she'd want to cover it up and she might do this. But at the end, we all agree, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Okay, so even if she was, so what? Come on, I guess maybe they think voters would care, and especially their voters, because
your voters don't care about anything.
Well, I mean, that's a good point.
You can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and they'll still support you.
Right, but 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump, and maybe they think they care on that issue. But in reality, it's your own personal life. Nobody should give a damn what you did with it, as long as you didn't hurt anyone else.
Exactly.
And even if you did, if it was under the contours of what you had agreed to, that's fine. all right, guys, we're out of time. So when we come back for the post game, we'll discuss a little bit of what we're going to do with the new resources and some of the potential fun things that we can bring to you guys. So tytnetwork.com/join join us as a member of the Young Turks and get all the post games and old schools. And don't forget the Arian Foster interview at 11:30 a.m. Eastern tomorrow morning if you're a member. Bye-bye.